Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tom Drew. And Tom Drew is an experienced guest when we talk about politics or sports. But and those are part of his professional life as well. I know him as the head man at Phoenix Communications, which is primarily, Tom, a PR and advice to inside advice to
large business.
That's right. Corporate
communications consulting.
Communications. But over the past number of years, you have become extraordinarily busy in terms of assisting people with fundraising, and I've got all my notes to identify you as president and CEO of Phoenix Communications, but you say, well, what we're really going to talk about today is fundraising. I want to be known as president and CEO of 501C Solutions.
That's correct.
There's a website for that, www.501, then C, then solutions,
plural. We got more than one. .com. Yep.
You want to tell us how communications led to fundraising?
Well, when I started Phoenix Communications, DG, I'd worked for two large corporations, Mobile Corporation, which became ExxonMobil, and Federated Department Stores, which became Macy's. And in both those places, I had worked both in the business of giving away money and being involved in philanthropy for local universities and Red Cross and that kind of thing. So Phoenix, as a PR firm, always had about 15% of its business as not-for-profit. And we wouldn't market it very heavily, but we did work for Duke University, and we did work for NC State and several not-for-profits, National Wildlife Federation.
So if you're consulting with nonprofits, it's got to be centered, a lot of it's got to be centered around ultimately raising money.
Exactly. But we would say if they will do it our way, which is a very communications-based way and a very volunteer, peer-to-peer ask way, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Very quickly, the history, though, about exactly four years ago, I looked around and I decided that I really enjoyed the fundraising council business, but it was hard to grow it out of a PR firm. So I got Renee Kiever, who was at Sigma Xi, to join up with me, and we created a new company called 501C Solutions. And we are fundraising consultants and counsel. Now, I say this because it should not be confused with being a fundraiser. The difference is we coach people, we motivate people, we train people, we show them how to raise money.
But you don't raise it. They got to do it.
They got to do it. We will even win some battles. We're a little more hands-on than a lot of consultants. We will take them to an ask. We will set it up. We'll go through it. But that's a battle. They'll win the war. And we will train them to win their wars.
Well, did you train yourself based on what you learned in providing communications consulting for nonprofits, or did you stop and go to school and learn how to do this from other people?
A little bit of both. It's a very good question. When I was at Federated Department Stores, we would have our staff support our CEO, and his name Ralph Lazarus, and he was on the board of Dartmouth. And so his involvement at Dartmouth, I was assigned to staff him and work with him. And I went to Dartmouth for almost twice a month for a year, and I learned fundraising at Dartmouth.
So this is interesting to me, Tom, and in a university community, this has got to be of interest to other people as well. So you are the public relations consultant for a head of a major corporation who happens, as his volunteer activity, to sit on the board of a private university that needs to raise money. And as he's the chairman of the board, he's responsible for that. And he needs help with that. He's used to having a staff.
That's right.
And so he gets you to go do the work in part to support him in his work as chairman. And so you have to come in and go gangbusters to help him make a difference fundraising responsibility. This is extraordinary. Well, so what did you do?
Well, our slogan was we maximized his effect and minimized his burden. In other words, the most important thing that a senior volunteer, a trustee or something can do is ask for the money. Staff or consultant can do everything else. Research, communications, set up the appointment, tell them everything they need to know about the prospect, even talk about the strategy, what to ask for, how much. I mean, to ask is the five R's, the right person, asking the right person at the right time for the right amount, and your charity is the right reason. And that's really all it is.
So oftentimes, let's just take this example of Mr. Lazarus, who's the Federated CEO, who's the chair at Dartmouth.
Right.
And what happens, we know often, is that somebody tells the chairman he's got to go out, you're chairman now, we need the money, would you call on your friends and raise the money? And the person feels responsible to do it. He goes out, and it's a failure. He goes out. He doesn't like to just walk into his buddy's office and say, can you give me $10 million? And it doesn't work.
But it's like any other kind of business or even athletic endeavor, DG. Preparation makes for better execution. So the preparation would be things like, we would tell him everything he needed to know about his prospect's involvement with Dartmouth, including his giving record. We would tell him his giving to other things, other charities. We would have a net worth estimate on his prospect, and we would give him a range for possible gift for the prospect. And so, in other words, I'm Ralph Lazarus, and you're D.G. Martin. And Ralph would come to you, and he would say, okay, D.G., our staff has given me a range for your gift of $400,000 to $600,000. Now, here was part of the key. Ralph had already given $500,000. So at Dartmouth, they were so sophisticated, peer-to-peer meant peer-to-peer also in the giving level.
Going to ask for more than I've already given.
Exactly. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. So you were looking at a guy who was a fellow alum or involvement, and you knew he had already given as much as he was asking you to give. So there was this peer-to-peer.
Does the asker say, or Mr. Lazarus say to the prospect, hey, Bill, I've given $500,000. I want you to do it. Or does somebody else?
But a very sophisticated prospect, first question they'll ask, what are you doing? Mm. And it's a beautiful thing. Then he says, well, I've given $500,000, and he tells why. Now, boy, we have jumped right into, we're right on the bottom line now. And so as a 21-year-old working for the CEO, I would watch these people, and he would say, okay, I'll give you 10,000 shares of IBM, I'll give you a home at Seminole, I'll give you 5,000 shares of Fidelity, and they would turn over to me, and they'd say, what does that add up to? And I'd say, $550,000, and it wouldn't be over, solicitation not over. So Mr. Lazarus would say, okay, now remember, you got your reunion, you got your annual gift, you've been involved with athletics, and you gave to performing arts. How do you want to break it up? It was very sophisticated. I'm talking about in the late 70s. You know, so
what was going on in your mind, and what are you learning there?
Well, I'm learning the power of peer-to-peer, which I had not seen in university work up until that time, and have seldom seen as strong since. They would say, you know, most places they say the college president needs to go ask this person, the college president. At Dartmouth, the college president was the asker of last resort. And I would say, oh, you're kidding me. They said, oh, no. Presidents come and go. Alums are forever, you know.
Well, now, that's not the – that we think of the head of the institution as being the chief fundraiser to this day.
Exactly.
But is that wrong?
Well, if you can do the other peer-to-peer, it's better. What the president can do, he has a role, the visionary. We need this money because – we see the future this way, and the future is going to require money. At Dartmouth, they would say, well, thank you very much. Good to see you out of the room, and that's you and me. Now, so I come down to Duke University. I take a job at Duke as assistant dean for external affairs for the new business school, kind of fledgling, you know. And Terry Sanford, my great mentor, tells me, it's going to be an easy job. I've got these people all lined up, you know, and so he sends me to see John Belk. Now, here's the lesson. I'm 28 years old at this point. I go see John Belk, and I walk in his office. I'd known him through retailing. I'd known him through my family, and wonderful, wonderful man, John, Titan of North Carolina. So I go in, and first thing he says, DG, it's a great story. Now, I'd seen peer-to-peer at Dartmouth, and Sanford says, no problem, just go see him. He says, Tom, let me get something off my chest. He says, you know, UNC and Davidson send these young people in here to see me. And he says, they've never made $100,000. They've never spent $100,000. They've never seen $100,000. But they're going to ask me for $100,000. Isn't that the craziest thing you ever heard of?
So there you are, 28 years old.
Exactly. I'd say, yes, sir, Mr. Belk. He said, oh, thank you for letting me get that off chest. Now,
what do you want?
I said, just want to say hi. And I tailed it up the road.
And what did you tell President Sanford?
We better find a peer. I wasn't it. And it proved the point.
And how did, just to follow up on this, I don't want to press you on this,
no.
wasn't a successful, ultimately no. successful thing, but where would you find the peer? What would you do just in general, what would you do? You come back and you're the development officer and you understand now he needs a peer. How are we going to find him? What do you do?
Well, what you do is you look at your board and you look at the people who are giving gifts of that kind of size. In that case, it would have been appropriate to ask J.B. Fuqua, who gave a pretty good chunk of money, if he would take four or five super prospects. And you set it up. And a lot of times people will look at you and they say, I don't like to ask for money. We had a situation at University of Alabama in athletics. Paul Bryan. I said, I'm working with the athletic director. I said, who's your largest giver? It's Paul Bryan. Paul Bryan? Yeah, Bear son. How much has he given? $35 million to the University of Alabama. I said, 30. He said, yeah. It says, when Bear was coach, you know, people try to put him in deals. He'd say, don't put me in a deal, put my son in a deal. And so all of a sudden, Paul Bryan Jr. has amassed a lot of money. Very shy person. I said, Mr. Bryan, just go with me. Just go with me. Be in the room. Look just like his father. So we go to Birmingham. We were trying to finish up Tide Pride campaign. We go in there, and I'd say, Mr. Jones, we're here to talk about our leadership level, $1 million. He'd say, oh, yeah, there's your father and I at the Sugar Bowl in 66. Yeah. And I said, well, we hope you'll join. I'm there. There we are at the Orange Bowl back in 69, you know. And he just sat there, you know.
He didn't even ask.
By the third one, Monday morning, I get a call. Tom, Paul Bryant, when are we going on one of them calls? So a star was born. The first successful one I had at Duke, DG, and it makes the point. I knew at the time I did the Duke campaign, I need the CEO of the largest Fortune 500 company in North Carolina to be head of my fundraising for the business school at Duke. So through our contacts like Charlie Wade and Mary Siemens, we asked Paul Stick, at the time the CEO of RJ Reynolds. So we go over there and he said, I'm so busy. This was back, you know, before Barbarians at the Gate, and they were expanding and changing. And Mr. Stick said, I'm just so busy.
I can't remember Paul Stick. Was he a North Carolinian or he?
No,
North
he actually
York?
Wasn't. He was the first professional CEO that they hired, you know, and he followed.
So he didn't have a long-standing connection with North Carolina.
He had been CEO of two or three companies.
What was your pitch to him?
Here it was. I said, we really need your help, Mr. Stick. I said, I will meet you in any airport in the world one time a month for 15 minutes. And your job will be to make a phone call or sign letters or work on a strategy. And he laughed and he said, you're pretty determined. I said, I only need 15 minutes a month of your time. He said, fine. So, of course, the first one we do is at Whitaker Place, the headquarters. And we go in there and he said, Tom, what are we doing today? And I said, we're calling IBM. He said, well, tell me about it. I said, well, we're asking them for $500,000. The local people think it's too much because it's only the business school at Duke, and they've got NC State and UNC to worry about. But the proposal is in at Armonk. We've got Paul Rizzo, who at the time was working for IBM, to support it. We've got regional person from Atlanta to support it. And I said, you need to call John Akers.
You know that they're friends. You know that they're...
Well, I knew CEO. They're on the business roundtable together. And so he says, okay. Grabs the phone. John Paul, How you doing, John? Oh, yeah, well, that was a lucky putt at the Greenbrier last year. Hey, John, you know, last year we helped you with the United Negro College Fund. Well, thank you, John. We tried to do our thing. My charity this year is the business school at Duke. Well, we have a proposal in for $500,000. You are the top recruiter of Duke MBAs. Well, thank you, John. Oh, that's great, John. I really appreciate it, John. See you at Homestead. He looked at me and said, see you next month.
That's a great story. Talking to Tom Drew. Tom Drew is my good friend politically, sports-wise, and now as the president and CEO of 501c Solutions. He's counseling me about how you raise money, and he and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is V.G. Martin. My guest is Tom Drew. Tom, you're the president of 501c Solutions. Where'd that name come from?
Well, we counsel and consult with people who are in the business of raising money. And as you well know, D.G., the tax code says that not-for-profits are called 501c3 organizations. But, you know, 501c6 organizations are membership organizations like chambers, and C4 organizations are advocacy organizations like political. All raise money.
So all of it in the that is the code for insiders who know that this is about
not
raising money.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier before we took the break that you're in the fundraising council business,
right?
And rather than in the arm twisting business, that you don't raise money but you help organizations figure out how they can use their contacts, experiences to raise money for themselves.
Exactly.
I'd love for you to tell some more stories. You were talking about what you learned, and
right.
You talked about what you learned working at Dartmouth and then at Duke.
Mm-hmm.
How I think the thing that intrigues me is in motivating, I don't want to say shy people, but motivating people who think that they can't raise money
right.
into effective fundraisers. And you talked about Paul Ryan, the son of the coach who said shy doesn't want to raise money,
right.
but you turned him around.
Correct.
How do you do that?
Well, it's like coaching. I mean, you should see your clients, volunteers as your team, you know, and you are the coach. That means that you're going to show them how to do this. You're going to show them how to shoot. You're going to show them how to play defense. You're going to have to show them. And in cases in practice or in the early going, you're going to actually have to demonstrate it. You know, so you better know what you're talking about. But at the end of the day, the one thing a volunteer can do that a hired gun can't do is the passion for the organization. And so when it comes down to the passion for the organization and the leverage of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, volunteer can do that better than consultant or staff every time.
You know, one of the things that this is not one of the things, but here's the way I think a lot of people involved in nonprofits look at it. It is that somebody else is going to raise the money. I'm not here to raise the money. I'm here to provide wisdom and counsel and
That's right.
judgment and help this organization be better, but I'm not responsible for the fundraising. So there are three approaches, I guess, to that. One is that the head of the organization has to raise his or her own money to support his or own salary, and that person's got to spend a lot of time on the road raising money.
Right.
The other is that we'll get a development officer, and then it's his or her function to go out and
right.
raise money from all of these people. And then the third one, we've been talking some about that, and that is that it's the board's responsibility. The board chair particularly has got to be fundamentally
right.
responsible for that. And what are the problems with each of those models, and how
well,
do you get around them?
Well, the problem is often your president of your organization is not a peer to the people that he or she has to ask for money from, and they feel awkward about it. Sometimes they can't even articulate it. But doing the vision thing, nobody can do that better, and they have got to learn. Their best thing is the vision thing, the volunteer's best thing is the ask thing, and the staff's best thing is to make both of them set up so that they can do it effectively and in the best conditions. We tell all organizations we work for that we expect the board members to do four things. Now, some will do three, some will do one, some will do two. The four things are: a board member can give money. I can't imagine somebody being on a board of a not-for-profit not expecting to give the not-for-profit some money. But there are a lot of them who do. They think they're there for their name and wisdom. Number two, they can ask for money. Well, when we go in at first, a lot of people say, I don't like to ask for money. We'll work with that. Three, they could open doors. I have a friend, D.G. Martin. He has a very important thing. It'd be a personal favor to me if you would see. Or four, they can provide some information. Do you know how rich D.G. Martin is? Let me tell you. All four things are important. All four things are important.
Well, how do you mobilize? How do you mobilize those assets? And how do you?
Well, you do. You run training sessions. You run workshops. I've at the University of New Mexico. In the last 6 months, we have created what we call special forces for athletics. We have 12 people. They have been trained. They have gone through role play. They have gone through case studies. They are all assigned at least five prospects with numbers associated to the prospect, what the prospect should possibly give. And they are all committed to making a major gift before they ask for one. And that's a place where 2 years ago I walked in and people told me it's a poor state. Yeah, we just don't raise money like other places.
Well, help me with this. I'm putting myself in the role of the sort of the chief development officer, mm-hmm. and that person is caught in this, has taken the job, right. expected to raise money, really can't raise money unless things are working right and he or she has got the right support and help from the president of the organization, the chief professional on the staff and the board, and you come in and that person all of a sudden comes into you and says, they won't do anything to help me, they expect me to write letters and turn out the thing, and all of a sudden magically
have you been in the closet anyway, that happens a lot, DG. What the development officer must learn, the most effective role for the development officer will be the leader of the three-ring circus. The development officer needs to orchestrate fundraising. The development officer need not put themselves in a position where they feel like, if I don't ask for the money, I don't get credit for it. And a lot of them do, and that's too bad. You know, because the first job I really had, I told my boss, I said, don't ever say, how much did you ask for and how much did you get? Look at my program and tell me how much my program raised. So a great staff person is a marionette. I mean, is pulling the strings, is setting things up. And making sure it all happens. And I tell you, one of the geniuses at doing this was John Piva at Duke. Brilliant, understaffed, a late maturing body of graduates. He raised $2.3 billion. He had a president who committed 85% of her time to fundraising. Now, she was selling a lot of vision. He had a board of trustees.
Was she making the ask, or was she?
Sometimes she did.
But she was.
She would make asks mainly to institutions like a foundation mm-hmm. or a corporation. But mainly she was supporting doing the vision for the volunteers. He had a board of trustees that personally gave or raised $550 million among themselves. And very few trustees made one gift. The largest giver made five gifts. Started at $50 million and ended up giving $130 million before it was over. And there was John Piver just pulling all the strings.
Well, I want to come back to the role of the development officer, mm-hmm. but does this mean that then if you're a nonprofit, that your board should not have people on there who are, if you want to have a successful fundraising drive, you better get people on your board who are able to give.
And get. Give and get. Yep. That's exactly right. And I'll come in and they'll say, well, look at our board. And I will be very honest with them. I'll say it's weak or it's strong. Or if you want to have a board that is celebrities and names, that's fine. But that's not going to help me raise your money. And then I'll create another organization to raise the money.
We're visiting with Tom Drew, who's the president and CEO of 501C Solutions. He and I'll be right back. Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm learning about fundraising from one of the experts, Tom Drew, also my buddy from politics, sports. Just happens to be on the wrong side, on the sports side. he's from Duke and True Blue, aren't you, Tom?
Yes,
you don't
I
make
am.
No apologies about that.
No apologies. A 14 support. Members of a family go to a school, you're kind of stuck.
And it's left you with an inside. Whenever you need anything from President Obama, you can call your buddy.
Reggie Love. You call Reggie Love.
I did, thanks to you. Woke him up and on the campaign trail.
That's right.
I don't think he has the same cell phone number. But we're talking about raising money for nonprofits, and that's your business, and
that's
you're
right.
sharing some of the insights with us. I'm sort of playing the role of the development officer in a small or a large nonprofit, and all of a sudden the board says we're bringing in 501c solutions to be our counsel. I'm just scared to death.
Yeah, right.
Because the consultant, if he's going to make any money, is going to tell them that I've been doing everything all wrong.
That's
so
real.
How do you?
No, that's
how
not
you,
true.
You know that's
no,
what
no, no.
The, how
I,
do you
I
come
understand.
In and sweet talk the development officer into believing that you're going to be his or her ally rather than enemy?
Well, first, I can't be good or effective without a person on the inside dedicated to fundraising. Now, that's no small thing. Because there are a lot of organizations that just have a president and two or three staff, and none of them are assigned fundraising full time. And I tell all these people, I say, I want somebody in the shower in the morning thinking about how to raise money for your organization, and in the car going home at night still thinking about raising money for your organization. Don't tell me part of their responsibility is fundraising, but they spend 6 months on the Christmas party. That doesn't help me. You know, I need somebody inside. Very small organizations, sometimes I only get somebody half-time or three-quarters time. But I want somebody that's clearly thinking of working, trying to do fundraising. Because I'm not effective. Remember.
Now, this is
important. I'm a gunslinger.
I'm
a mercenary.
No, but what you're saying is very important. And I shouldn't interrupt you, but you're not answering my question, which was, I got the fundraising officer in place. And that fundraising officer has got a consultant coming in, hired by the board chair or by the head of the organization, and it is a slap in my face that I hadn't been able to do it. What do you say to that person when you go talk to them?
My job is to make that person better, like to make the organization better. My consulting is only going to stop where they start where they stop. So I'm only going to sit there. I first have to analyze and evaluate that person, their experience, their resources, the people they're working with, the board, and then as the outside consultant, if I need to tell the president of the organization, you can't do it with the resources that you have. It's not John Doe's fault. John Doe needs more help. Or John Doe's got a bad board. Or you're not devoting enough for your time to fundraising. We will do that. And being a good consultant sometimes means delivering disappointing news.
Yeah, well, I'm this officer, but I know that sometimes you're going to come in and say, well, DG's a nice guy, but he's not the right person for you in the development office. I mean, you in honesty, you will have to report that. So I still feel threatened by you, no matter what you say.
I understand. We had a situation one time with a pretty big university, very big state university, that wanted to raise $15 to $25 million for athletics. And we did this study, and we were trying to write the final report. And I was talking to my colleagues, and I said, I had an epiphany. I said, okay. If you put a gun to my head and you tell me everybody I ask for money is going to say yes, based on what we know, I go out, how much money do you think we can raise? And they scratched their heads, and I don't know, what do you think? I said, $3 to $5 million. And they said, wow, these people want 15 at least. And so I said, we're looking at the wrong thing. Let's look at what they have to do in order to get into position to raise $15 million. And believe it or not, it was in annual giving. They didn't have a strong enough, large enough database to begin with to get to major gifts. And so we told them they should spend 2 years and improve their annual giving, create new levels, move people up in their giving, and then they would be ready to talk about how many prospects did they have to raise $15 million. And the president and athletic director thanked me for telling the truth.
So are you out of work for 2 years until
that's done? We stay in touch, but we're out of work.
We're visiting with Tom Drew. Tom Drew is the CEO of 501C Solutions. We're talking about raising money. He and I will be right back after this break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tom Drew. Tom's teaching me about fundraising. He's the head of 501C Solutions, also the head of a public relations and communications firm called Phoenix Communication. And on the side, he helps me on radio programs about sports and politics. And Tom, thanks. I'm learning a lot. Maybe I'll go back in the development world now that I've been educated.
You're in the development world.
One of the things, you're one of the challenges, as you were just talking about, for organizations is always there are people who are willing to assert how much money the nonprofit needs to meet its objectives.
Right.
And very often that will be the basis for setting a fundraising goal. Yet part of your work is helping organizations as best they can, but in a kind of organized way, determine what might be possible. And how do you what do you do if you're asked, if an organization is wise enough to say, help us determine how much we might raise? What's your approach?
Well, we usually do a feasibility study, and that's where we will talk to 35 to 50 people who are involved with the organization heavily or tangentially, you know, or we might talk to civic leaders in the area where the organization exists to find out the impressions of the organization outside of the inner ring. And we'll do, they're usually 40 minutes to an hour long interviews. So we'll get 45, 50, 60 hours of interviews with these people. And we ask them, you know, all about 15 to 20 of the same kind of questions.
Like what?
Were your impressions of the organization? And then we'll come all the way down to, what do you think of the mission of the organization? We'll come down to, okay, you're king for a day. You need to ask five people for $100,000. Who would you ask? So we're building up a lot of information, including a big prospect list. Because, and then we will ask, okay, how about the young up-and-comers? Who would you ask for $20,000?
So you're doing more than assessing. You're already doing prospecting for the organization.
And we're communicating, too, because we're talking to their best people to kind of tell them what's coming. And we're also assessing leadership. You know, we can come back and say, oh, D.G. Martin is hot for you. You guys got a person here, you know. So we get an awful lot of information the organization can't get by itself.
And then how do you translate that into a dollar figure of what might be a reasonable goal for a fundraising campaign?
Well, there are lots of rules of thumb. I mean, there are fundraising books and everybody. Some people take their annual giving database and they will do a multiple of that. You know, this is kind of like trying to analyze businesses, you know, and run rates and things like that. You can also look at the major gift experience of the people you're talking to, what kind of money they're giving to other things. You can look at what I call the wow factor of what you're trying to do and say, you know, you're going to put a monument to Caesar Pelley in downtown Chapel Hill. Would you support that? You know, so, I mean, there are a lot of things you can do like that. And then you try to come to an estimate, you know, based on real people with real numbers beside them that you think are possible. But then you can put conditions in it. We did a feasibility study recently, and we told the client they had to meet 14 conditions in 7 months in order to raise the money they wanted to raise. And if they didn't, number would change. And you say, well, why would the number change? It changed for two reasons. One, in 7 months, decision makers at some of the organizations we talked to changed. Politicians changed. Foundation boards changed. Corporations changed. Then the other thing, too, is really a feasibility study is so existential that the data that it generates is only good for a year or less. because you're looking at the world now, not 6 or 8 months from now. A lot of things can happen. Donor fatigue, volunteer transition. And you've got to try to take all that into account. We did a recent feasibility study. We gave them 3 different scenarios. What happens in 7 months, what happens in 10 months, and what happens in 12 months.
Well, speaking of changing circumstances, the most noticeable change in circumstance as far as fundraising is concerned is a change in the economic conditions in the country and in the lives and fortunes of many of the people around here who are generally supportive of many different good causes, at least in small ways. And what has been the impact so far of the downturn in the economy on nonprofit fundraising around here and other places, and what do you look for in the future? And finally, since we're just about out of time, now this might be my last question. Yeah. What do people do when their donors are not able to give right now but might be able to give later?
Well, it's a good question. First, we found annual giving has not only done well, I mean, it has increased. There are people who are actually giving small gifts, more in the small gifts than they did before because of the economy. That shows their passion for the organization. Interesting. Planned giving is, that's coming on. And that's great because planned gifts are good for major gifts. I don't want to be morbid, but if you have a 500-person group, legacy fund or whatever, people older than 60 years old that leave your organization in your will, 3 or 4 are going to die every year. And that's going to be millions of dollars for your organization. Planned giving, going great. $1 million giving is doing fine because people who can afford to give away $1 million. Sure, I had a net worth of $45 million. Now, because of the economy, my net worth is $35 million. I don't feel much of change. That's okay. Here's where the economy is going to hurt, although it hasn't net yet. Is in the $50,000 to $250,000 giver. And let me tell you why. That's like the Wall Street person or the big corporate executive, and that person may have been laid off, and that person depends on their income for everything and invests their income in the stock market. So they got 2 strikes going against them recently. 1, going to lose their job. 2, they put their money away in the stock market. Now, 3, the economy is not going to reabsorb them, DG. So they may be on severance or workout right now. That's going to end, and they're still not going to have a job. So that major gift giver at the 50 to 250 range is going to be the one most affected, I believe, in fundraising. The problem is everybody's been in denial, and it hasn't happened yet.
Well, one of the strong donor groups that you mentioned were corporations, and surely that the downturn's got to have a big impact on
it. It has had a big impact. What we think is 70 to 75% of the corporations will tell you that their giving has changed, 70, 75%. Now, about 60% is changed for a good reason. They're not making as much money. Then you've got a certain percentage in there that are using the economy as an excuse to change. And then you've got another group in there, the Amazon.coms, that haven't changed at all, and they're still giving what they used to. That's corporate foundations. Whew, that's the tough one. Foundations stayed quiet in the fourth quarter because they were in denial, but they got to January 1 and they found out how much they had lost in their corpus, their portfolios, and all of a sudden 25-35% down. They not only are not making any new gifts this year, they are telling some of their multi-year commitments, we got to wait a year.
That they're not going to honor it.
No, so they're not going to honor it.
That has a big impact, as you were talking earlier in this segment about feasibility studies, that you have to take
that into consideration.
That's not going to be like that.
So we tell everyone, build your annual giving, build your database, do your fundamentals now, do your research now. Don't worry about your big donors. They're going to be there, your big donors. Now, the difficulty is look to that 50 to 250 in your annual giving and your deferred giving. Anyone 50 years old is a good deferred giving prospect. Colleges often don't like it because presidents think, I'm not going to be here long enough to see that gift. And advancement officers think that too. I want to tell you, 2 of my most successful clients in 08, planned giving. Planned giving made up 40 to 50% of their total.
Tom Drew, thank you. Tom Drew has been my guest. He's the President and CEO of Phoenix Communications, of course, and also, and more importantly for this segment, of 501c Solutions. You taught us a lot about fundraising. Hope you'll come back soon, Tom.
Thank you, DJ.
Thanks to Tom, and thanks all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.